From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Rowdy Yates, The Man with No Name, Dirty Harry, and Will Money. We talk with Clint Eastwood and with his biographer, Richard Schickel. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead introduces us to the work of a young tenor saxophonist from New York, Patrick Zimmerle. And Gerald Early continues his reflections on life at an African-American university. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The United Nations Refugee Agency says it has finally located up to 700,000 missing Rwandan refugees in eastern Zaire by using surveillance planes and satellite photos. There are new reports of fighting today in the region as Rwandan-backed rebels search out Hutu gunmen in eastern Zaire. Nations that had agreed to participate in the Canadian-led multinational force to help the refugees are now questioning the need for such a mission. Officials met at the United Nations yesterday to discuss the force. And the BBC's Rob Watson has more.
The meeting was inconclusive, but Canada's Deputy Foreign Minister, Gordon Smith, told reporters that there was a consensus that military planners needed to carry on working on a number of options. He said they ranged from not sending any troops at all to a scaled-down version of the 10,000-strong operation planned last week. Mr. Smith insisted that the political will still existed for whatever action was necessary.
If there is a humanitarian need that requires military intervention to provide security to those UN and other organizations delivering vital aid, my clear sense is that the international community will be there.
Mr. Smith said part of the problem in deciding on which option to pick was the difficulty in gaining accurate information.
Rob Watson at the UN. The Federal Aviation Administration is hiring scores of new inspectors to check for hazardous cargo aboard passenger jets in the wake of the ValueJet crash. And FAA official Bruce Butterworth told a meeting of the National Transportation Safety Board today that the agency plans to pursue criminal charges against anyone who sends hazardous material aboard commercial aircraft. The FAA has been criticized for lax oversight of potentially hazardous cargo. The NTSB says it's leaning toward human error as the cause of the deadly crash of a commuter plane and a private plane in Quincy, Illinois. The collision killed 14 people. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
There are teams of National Transportation Safety Board officials examining evidence and conducting tests as they try to determine what caused the fiery collision between a United Express commuter flight and a small private King Air prop plane. Since the Quincy Airport has no control tower, the pilots were supposed to communicate on a radio frequency. George Black with the NTSB.
There are more uncontrolled airports than there are controlled airports, and thousands of uncontrolled takeoffs and landings occur every day. And we don't have midairs every day, so apparently they operate much of the time safely.
The Quincy Airport is scheduled to reopen Friday. A memorial service for the 14 victims will be held Sunday. In Quincy, I'm Cheryl Corley.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 21 points in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 5.5. This is NPR News. An explosion at a shoe store in San Juan has killed at least 19 people and injured 50. 11 people are still missing. The blast ripped a hole as wide as a house in the side of the building and left a tangle of concrete and steel beams. Puerto Rican authorities believe a natural gas leak triggered the explosion. President and Mrs. Clinton have entered the vacation phase of their visit to Australia. They're spending the next 2 days at one of the country's nicest resorts before heading to a trade conference in the Philippines. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
The Clintons left Sydney late today after the president concluded one of the most talked about events of his trip here, a round of golf with Australian champion Greg Norman, otherwise known as the Shark. Mr. Clinton made a harbourside address to the people of Sydney in the early afternoon and then climbed into his limo and headed for the New South Wales Country Club. It was a chilly afternoon, but Mr. Clinton, Norman, and two other guests played a full 18 holes. It's a rolling course overlooking the entrance to Botany Bay. As dusk fell, the President and Mrs. Clinton said their farewells and flew to the resort town of Port Douglas. Here they'll relax, snorkel, and see the Great Barrier Reef. It's a fairly open schedule, perhaps leaving time for more golf. I'm Vicki O'Hara with the President in Port Douglas.
A nonpartisan panel is suggesting a shakeup in the way top government officials are picked and confirmed. The 20th Century Fund in Washington has a task force that says many appointees should not have to endure often abusive Senate scrutiny, and Senate rules should be changed to reduce partisanship. An 18-year-old college freshman has surrendered to the FBI in Delaware on charges of murdering his girlfriend's newborn son. Brian Peterson Jr. was accompanied by his parents and an attorney. The baby was found in a trash bin outside a motel in Newark, Delaware, last week. Peterson and the child's mother could face the death penalty if convicted in the case. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Rhino Records, producers of Stan Freberg's comic view of history, The United States of America, Volume 1, The Early Years, and the new Volume 2, The Middle Years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've been a fan of Clint Eastwood ever since he started herding cattle on the TV western Rawhide. When he teamed up with Italian director Sergio Leone for the spaghetti westerns A Fistful of Dollars and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Eastwood began his transformation from actor to icon.
Listen, stranger, didn't you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
See, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you men fired those shots at his feet. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the mule, he just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize...
I don't think it's nice, you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
After Eastwood reworked the Western genre, he revitalized cop movies with his Dirty Harry series.
I know what you're thinking, punk. You're thinking, did he fire six shots or only five? Now, to tell you the truth, I forgot myself in all this excitement. But being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and will blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself questions. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
After years as an action hero blowing people away on screen, Clint Eastwood directed and starred in the movie Unforgiven, which reflected on the cost of violence.
A hell of a thing killing a man. You take away all he's got, and all he's ever gonna.
I spoke with Clint Eastwood and with Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who has written a new biography of Eastwood. Eastwood got his big break with Rawhide. I told Eastwood that judging from the biography, I probably liked Rawhide a lot more than he did. He played Rowdy Yates, the young assistant trail boss. Eastwood used to call the character Rowdy Yates' trail flunky and Rowdy Yates' idiot of the plains.
Actually, I liked the role. It was we just used to sit around the set and use self-demeaning kind of humor as a way of keeping our sanity out there doing a series week in, week out. And I think that Eric Fleming used to call himself Mr. Failure instead of Mr. Favier, and I used to call myself Rodney Yates trail flunky. And we'd just kind of, just joke about it. It was nothing that nobody disliked the series particularly. We just had, it was just kind of a way, and somebody picked up on it, I guess, is that it was a total unhappiness. It wasn't unhappiness, it was just kind of a way that to keep yourself amused, I suppose. Eventually, when you do a series, after the years go by, you do start to get frustrated. You'd like to go on and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I'm no exception in that case.
I think, too, that Rowdy was, boyish beyond his years toward the end of the series. I think maybe that Clint wanted to be, a somewhat more dangerous figure, thus a more interesting figure to act. I mean, I'm kind of guessing there based on some of our conversations, but I think, any actor trapped in a role that seems to be relatively unchanging is eventually going to say, how come I don't get to, mm-hmm. romp and stomp a little bit?
Well, Clint Eastwood, you started your career as a contract player at Universal Studios in the kind of last gasp of the studio system. Were you being groomed for a particular type of role? Did they see you as a type?
No, they didn't see me hardly at all. they put people under contract in those days, then they promptly forget about them and hire back people that they'd had under contract in previous years. But I don't think I was being groomed for anything. They just were taking a shot, and there you are, and they put you in for 6 months or a year. You had an option every 6 months on these type of terms, and so they could drop you at any time. And they give you a quick evaluation after a year and say, well, maybe you're okay, maybe you're going to go somewhere, or maybe they put them in a bit part and the person shined. I played a lot of bit parts, but none of them particularly shined at that point.
Did you have any sense that your future was going to be in Westerns and in action films? Did you have a sense of that for yourself?
No, a lot of people thought, well, he's a tall guy, maybe he'd be good in Westerns. For some reason, somebody thinks that Western heroes are tall guys for some reason. That sort of based upon the predecessors of Gary Cooper, John Wayne, Randolph Scott, and what have you over the years. But so they thought, well, maybe he'll play in Westerns or what have you. But nobody really knew. No, I was just kind of out there and hanging about, studying acting, and it was a steady job. It was kind of nice at the time.
Many of the roles you've played have been, men who are very strong, but men of few words. And it's ironic that your screen test for Rawhide was a long monologue that you were really uncomfortable with because you were having trouble at the time just remembering all of the words in this long monologue, and you didn't think of that as your strength as an actor. What do you think came through about you, even though you missed some of the words in the monologue?
Well, it was amusing because they told me it was going to be an interview test, and I'd done interview tests before.
This is where you just talk with the director?
Exactly. You just talk with the director, and I disliked those intensely because sometimes they ask you, what's your name? Why did you do this? Why? It's a quick interview, usually by somebody who doesn't know how to do interviews, and you sit there on film and look sort of drop-jawed. But this was a test where they said, here, would you like, how are you at learning lines? I said, pretty good. And the guy said, here, well, here's a whole page of dialogue. I said, could you be ready to do this in a half hour? And so I thought, well, I'd just take the different beats and play those and the different changes in the scene, kind of play those up and see how it would go and just use my own words. The director happened to be the writer in that case, and he liked every word that he had written, so he was a little bit taken back. But it worked out all right in the end, because the people who viewed it and made the final decision didn't know the dialogue and could care less. They just wanted to see a look and a certain expression.
Why do you think you've gravitated to parts that are parts of few words? Is it that you don't like to remember or learn lines, or is it a sensibility thing that you gravitate more
toward?
No,
it's just a sensibility thing. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of Fistful of Dollars, a first feature film I played in...
With Sergio Leone,
that I thought that the character would be much more interesting the less he spoke, the less you knew about him. I thought it would be... He'd be a more interesting character, and that often happens when you're doing a character in a play. That the person who talks the most, after a while, you get tired of hearing the conversation. You want to know what's inside. Sometimes a silent moment, you can set up more of an effect than you can by just rambling on reams of dialogue. But later on, it's changed. My last picture, they couldn't shut me up.
one of the things I noticed that Clint said, and it's in the book, is I think he likes himself as a viewer of movies. He prefers to kind of lean in to hear. In other words, I think he has a feeling that a little bit of mystery about a character doesn't fully explain himself at every minute. Is a character that draws us toward the screen, whereas if a guy's explaining himself constantly, you sort of say, well, why couldn't I be allowed to figure this out for myself? And it can kind of push you back from the screen instead of drawing you in.
Yeah, and Rawhide, too, those years, a lot of times the screenwriting that would come in on those scripts would be very expository. In other words, they felt that they had to explain a lot of things in one scene, so they wouldn't have to film other scenes. And you get so tired of reeling out exposition that you felt that this was an opportunity to just use a little bit of economy and see if you could tell a story that way.
Well, in some of your action roles, in some of your westerns and like Dirty Harry films, you not only don't say a lot, but what you do say, you're saying often through clenched teeth, in that really guttural voice. How did you develop that style of speaking?
I don't know what you're talking about. Well, I think that the character just drives you in that. It's a character who's maybe... frustrated with the things that the common person on the street are frustrated with, the bureaucracy that we live in, the nightmare that we as a civilization have placed on ourselves. I think this is a person who is frustrated with that, especially if you're trying to solve a case in a limited amount of time. I don't know. It's just the thought of the time.
One of the things that Clint said to me that I thought was interesting and amusing is that, he did five Dirty Harry films. He said, well, the thing about Dirty Harry is he always got the best lines in the movies. I mean, he didn't have the most lines, but, Harry Callahan generally got the topper. The funny, smart, well-turned phrase, some of which have become catchphrases.
Okay, now the onus is on one of you to recite a couple of those phrases.
I am not doing my Clint Eastwood imitation. I'll go ahead, Clint, make her day.
Yeah, the make my day line or the do you feel lucky punk kind of lines were lines that people gravitated towards.
Did you have a sense of that reading the script that, presidents would be, making, improvising on those lines, and that they would just enter the general vocabulary? Could you read a script and say these lines are going to last beyond the film?
Nobody can say that for sure, but you can kind of you can kind of find the lines that are sort of squelch lines, the ones that come in and put a topper on it. I think the appeal of some of those early characters was the fact that the man would have the right answer, and it was always usually very terse and kind of right to the point, but with a little bit of humor involved. So everybody said, God, I would love to be able to do that.
Have you ever been able to do that, have just the right comeback at just the right moment?
Very rarely.
Right. Now, when you're doing a line like Make My Day, and you know, okay, this is a really good line, do you, like, go home and do line readings and go, make my day, make my day, make my day, and just do it over and over until you figure out exactly how you want to do it?
Looking into the bathroom right. mirror and doing some of your best acting.
Are you talking to me?
No, I don't go over the lines. I don't play them out loud. I'd rather play them for the first time when I do them.
No,
and
really?
I usually do them by the motivation of what the feelings are at the time. So I start them from what the intent is, and then let it kind of go out. It's sort of like a blowing through a trumpet or something. You start, and the sound magnifies as it comes out. If you sit there and practice line readings to yourself, you'll just get confused.
My guests are Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who's written a new biography of Eastwood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Richard Schickel and Clint Eastwood. Richard Schickel has written a new biography of Clint Eastwood. I want to get to your spaghetti westerns, the films you made with Sergio Leone. You started the Sergio Leone films when you were still making Rawhide, the TV western. How did Sergio Leone get to see Rawhide and decide you were the one to star in his western?
He had seen an episode that somebody had was showing around, an agency had in Rome, and he had seen an episode, and they thought, well, here's a chance to hire an American actor who has been doing westerns but is not very expensive. And that, they didn't have any
right.
They didn't have any money to spend, so they didn't have a lot of choices as far as names of the moment.
What was it like for you to make the transition from upstanding assistant trail boss to mystery western tough guy?
Well, it was great fun because all of a sudden I was playing something completely different than I had been playing, and I got to experiment a lot. I could do we'd do everything with a look. Leone was very visual. And unlike television, where sometimes they just want to shoot talking heads, he was shooting in a very kind of an expansive way, and it was fun. It was also fun to work with a European crew, and watch other people who see their approaches to it and how it all unravels from their point of view over there.
There's a lot of really interesting facial close-ups in your movies with Sergio Leone. And he had a very iconographic way of shooting faces, particularly your face. And your face in those close-ups is often, mysterious, unknowable. Instead of the facial close-ups like revealing this essence of who you are, they reveal the unknowability of who you are. And I've always wondered, what were you thinking during those close-ups to get the right expression on your face?
The first response would be to say absolutely nothing. To get the George Cukor used to say he'd tell Greta Garbo sometimes to look into the camera and stare and don't think about a thing. But that's maybe a little oversimplification or a way to get a certain effect out of her at that time. But you think about what you're doing with the plot line, what the demands are of the plot. Usually, because this character, though he wasn't saying a lot, he was plotting a lot, And so you just thought about what your next moves were. It's just a question of thinking like you would in regular, in real life. You don't, and you may be thinking, you have an inner monologue. Every actor plays an inner monologue as you're playing your outer character. And sometimes your outer character is saying, good evening, it's wonderful to see you. But underneath you might be saying, yeah, dirty, rotten. So, you know, you really don't... care. And so that's your inner monologue. And so I might have been saying something like that to myself at the time, is, you know, you develop- I don't like these guys. I'd like to, you know, blow them all away, but I'd be very pleasant at the moment.
You developed a squint also in some of those close-ups.
Well, that was just the sunlight. And
was it?
Yeah. They bomb me with a bunch of lights and you're outside and it's 90 degrees. It's hard not to squint.
Richard Schickel, I want to ask you what you think of the importance of the Sergio Leone films in Clint Eastwood's filmmaking career.
Oh, I sort of think that Clint would have made his way into wider public consciousness in some other fashion, but I do also feel that those movies were so singular. They were truly, deeply, profoundly revisionist Westerns, as Clint has often said, at a time when the Western was in a kind of a dull place. The traditions of the Western in America had been kind of used up, and though we were in a period where Westerns were very popular in television and coming out of a period in which they had been very popular in the theaters, nonetheless, you know, the basic Western moves, the traditional moves, had become dull and overused and kind of cliché-ridden. And I think it's one of the things that drew Clint to this was that opportunity, not just for his own character to expand a bit, but for him to participate in a kind of a revision of a form that he actually liked. I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, Clint does know quite a bit about film history and so forth. He had seen Yojimbo, the Kurosawa movie, which was a source for this particular movie, for Fistful of Dollars, and he'd seen it 2 years before and had said, hey, this would make a great Western, but I don't think anybody in America will make it because it's too tough. And here were these crazy Italians who were, you know, willing to do exactly that.
Clint Eastwood, since there's been these great iconographic close-ups of your face, I'm wondering what you think of your face as a man, an actor, and as a director, because you've had to work with your face as a director and look at it very objectively, I'd imagine.
As a director, you think of yourself as another character. A lot of times when I'm talking to the editor, I'll say, when he comes in the room and she does this and hey, that goes here and what have you, I never think of myself in the first person. It's just you have to do that, and you know you don't dwell on your face. You dwell on the fact that you're there and the character. And if you think too much about certain things, you can get yourself very confused. So, rather than do that, you just forge right on ahead with what you're doing.
Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who has written a new biography of Eastwood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Richard Schickel and Clint Eastwood will be back in the second half of our show.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bye.
Coming up, Dirty Harry and Unforgiven. We continue our conversation with Clint Eastwood and his biographer, Richard Schickel. Also, Gerald Early continues his reflections on guest teaching at an African-American university, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the young tenor saxophonist Patrick Zimmerle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Clint Eastwood and Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel, who has written a new biography of Eastwood. When we left off, we were talking about Eastwood's iconic role in the spaghetti westerns directed by Sergio Leone. Now, in Richard Schickel's book about you, he says that, Rawhide followed the strict production code of the time. You couldn't show a fired gun and the victim of the bullet in the same shot. There had to be an edit in between. What was your reaction to Sergio Leone's really vivid approach to violence?
Well, that was true. The Hays office at that time had a rule for Westerns only, ironically, and you couldn't show the shootee and the shooter in the same shot. It couldn't be a tie-up shot, in other words. So you'd have to do it as an individual cut. And if you look at even later American Westerns of High Noon, you won't see the tie-up. But Sergio didn't know about all that, and I wasn't about to tell him because I was really enjoying this. It was breaking all, we were trying to break all the molds. And in breaking all the molds, it made those pictures a hit, or was somewhat of a revisionist idea, or certainly an outsider's point of view. They became popular, but they also brought with it some resentment, as you and Richard touched on earlier in the show. There was a lot of people who felt that who was this upstart? We didn't come in and bless this guy to come along, and we didn't bless these movies to come along, an Italian interpretation of the great American genre. So there was a certain resentment that hung around with those pictures for some time. Now, as people look back on them, they enjoy the fact that there was a different this was a different period, and then it went on to somebody else. And Sam Peckinpah came along later, and he did another look at the Western. And someone else comes along and does another one. And I come back to him and take another shot. And somebody else down the line. That way, it keeps the great American art form alive.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting when you do look back at the Leone films is today. Despite all of the hubbub about their violence, they're not terribly violent movies by modern standards, by the standards of the 90s.
There's a lot of really sick, sadistic people in them.
That's true. And yet, Leone, for the most part, does not linger mm-hmm. on the actual violence. He lingers on the lead-up to violence.
I mean, the savoring of the violence.
There's a kind of a dance, and almost sort of stately minuet leading up to the violence. I mean, the concluding shootouts and these things it's a long and elegant time as people circle one another and in effect threaten one another. But the actual death is very quick. It's very clean. You know, we don't see a lot of blood squibs going off in the Peckinpah manner or slow motion death. Death is in these movies, as it so often is in life. I mean, it's quick, nasty, brutal, but it's not something that is in and of itself aestheticized. What's around it is aestheticized, but that the actual moment is not. It's shown for the brutal thing that it is.
The first Dirty Harry film was directed by Don Siegel, who you did several films with, including Coogan's Bluff, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, The Beguiled. What are some of the things you feel you learned about acting and directing from your association with him?
Well, directorially, he was a terribly efficient man who had come up through the ranks. Started out with a montage department at Warner Brothers many years before. He'd done quite a few second vision films, or B-movies, he used to call. Some of them quite good, some of them classics, like Invasion of the Body Snatcher. And he was terribly efficient, because he had to be. He never had the luxury of the big budgets and that some other directors might have had, and he was terribly underrated, because he could make a lot happen with very little. And so you learned how a person could go to work every day and be efficiently turn out a certain amount of work. I had worked with other directors like that. I'd worked with directors like that on in television, mm-hmm, some of them, mm-hmm, really quite good. But Don had never really captured the mainstream of Hollywood. I guess maybe because he was sort of a cantankerous guy and he sort of marched to his own drummer. But he, what you learn from somebody like that is, you don't have to sit and dwell and
be the great artiste.
You can be an artist, but not an artiste.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
The first Dirty Harry film was very controversial. A lot of people saw it as a cop who was a real law and order, right-wing kind of cop. Don't worry about reading somebody their rights. Don't worry about obeying the law. Just make the collar and, you know, get them behind bars. Paul Newman apparently turned down the role for political reasons. What did you see, Clint Eastwood, what did you see in this role when you took it on? What interested you in the character?
I saw an exciting detective story. I saw a script that was concerned about the victims of violent crime rather than the accused, so that was an interesting way to go. There was no big call to drop all rights of the accused of crime or anything like that. It just happened to be a frustrating situation, all set up by the Harry Julian Fink script of the fact that there was a time element in having to solve the case. There's nothing right-wing about that. There's nothing... they weren't intended to be that way. Don Siegel and myself just saw it as a chance to do an exciting film. If somebody wanted to politicize it, that's fine. There's a couple comments about Miranda and a few decisions like that, but I think there's been in recent years some discussion about that, maybe some of those decisions are not always practical. That's the way it is. I think the blue-collar person out there, the Mr. and Mrs. Middle America, who sit there and we're watching the press being constantly concerned with the accused and never once thinking about victims, saw this movie as somewhat of a breath of fresh air. Since that movie and that time, we're in another era now where they have victims' rights organizations and all kinds of attention put upon that. But at that particular time, nobody had the imagination to picture themselves the victim of violent crime.
Did you feel misunderstood?
It was misunderstood. It wasn't misunderstood. I think the public didn't misunderstand it at all. I think it was misunderstood by some people who felt that you had to put a political connotation to absolutely every film that's made, and sometimes there are times when you have to rely on the old Alfred Hitchcock adage that It's only a movie.
Clint Eastwood, I thought that your choice of directing and starring in The Unforgiven was such an interesting choice, because it's a movie about a man who goes from bad man to good man to myth. And it's also interesting because it's about the difficulty of killing someone and what it takes out of you when you do kill someone. And you'd been in so many mythic movies and been in so many movies where the character that you played killed a lot of people. So I'm interested in how you related to the story in The Unforgiven and how it dealt with myth-making and with violence.
Well, those exact things that you mentioned are what attracted me to the project, the fact that... But even though I had done pictures where I've been a police officer and Western films where I've had a lot of gunplay and stuff, it's not that I approved of that sort of thing. And I don't necessarily approve of the romanticizing of gunplay, and I don't think it's... And I thought here was a chance, here was a story that had... that sort of shot holes in that, if you'll pardon the pun, you know, it brought out the truth about gunplay and the fact that there is some loss to your soul when you commit an act of violence, and to play a person who was deeply affected in his life because of some of the mayhem that he'd been responsible for was to me made the character more interesting, and was more interesting for me to play, and in fact, I never thought the film would be really commercial when I was making it, because it had all these statements about mayhem and violence, and I thought maybe this might not be a straight ahead action movie that people wanted, but I liked the story and I felt it was worth telling.
My guests are Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who's written a new biography of Eastwood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Clint Eastwood and Richard Schickel, who's written a new biography of Eastwood. Well, Clint Eastwood, I feel like I must talk with you a little bit about music. And to kick off this chapter of our interview, let's listen to this.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me saddle my old saddle.
Terry, you should have seen the pain in this room, right?
And that's from the album Clint Eastwood Sings Cowboy Favorites. And there's a picture of Clint Eastwood as Rowdy Yates on the cover. Rawhide's Clint Eastwood Sings
that was,
Cowboy Favorites.
Yeah. I was the Milli Vanilli of the moment there. I did, that wasn't me.
Oh, yes, it was. I actually like your singing voice. I really do. I mean, this is a strange album with strange arrangements and not always good songs, but I really like your singing, and I imagine you're also like influenced by Chet Baker in your singing. And...
Well, that wasn't first place. That wasn't the kind of songs that I would normally like to sing.
The songs on here, I'd imagine not. Yeah. But you got to sing Cole Porter. Don't fence me in.
There's nothing wrong with that. Cole Porter is certainly wonderful. But what happened is that somebody had the brilliant idea that that I should do some cowboy songs, not country western songs, Nashville type, but real straight cowboy songs, and I wasn't sure whether I liked the idea, but they said, well, we'll do it, and we have a session tomorrow, and I said, well, tomorrow I'm leaving. Well, will you do it? You just stop by the studio on the way to the airport. So I did a whole album, You think about people who take 6 months to make an album, but this one, that we did the whole album in one session, and I didn't know the songs. I had to come in and learn them real quick, and some of them I knew, some songs like that you've heard as a child, but you don't really know them. And so it was a little frustrating. It wasn't my favorite musical experience in life, but it was, there again, you learn something every day.
Now, had you sung much before? Did you think of yourself as a singer at all?
Not really. I'd done a few things. I'd done a few records. I'd been involved in music, so I could sometimes carry a tune. My father loved singing. He had a group that played, and he loved to sing all the time. He would love to have been a singer more than anything, I think.
Now, I know you're still, and were as a young man, very passionate about jazz. Did you ever think that you'd become a professional musician instead of an actor and director?
Well, I thought about that earlier when I was a kid and I was doing some things, but I never thought, I never really knew what I wanted to do until I became an actor. And at that point, I kind of knew which direction I was going to at least make, get up and swing at the bat.
Would you like to sing more or play more? Or?
No, I don't have any there's one of my key sayings.
Yes.
A man must know his limitations.
Clint Eastwood and film critic Richard Schickel. Schickel has written a new biography of Eastwood.
When things look bad, and it looks like you're not going to make it, then you got to get mean. I mean plumb mad dog mean. Because if you lose your head and you give up, then you neither live nor win. That's just the way it is.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has been listening to a batch of new CDs, and he says the one that most caught his ear is by the young New York tenor saxophonist Patrick Zimmerle. Kevin has a review.
Reason there are more copycats than innovators in jazz is. Almost a century into the music's history, it's not easy to hit on good ideas someone hasn't claimed already. Bad ideas are always with us, but let's not get into that. Still, no matter what new ideas a musician brings to jazz, every new approach recycles old stuff. That's how we can hear it's jazz and not something else. Take, for example, the music of saxophonist Patrick Zimmerle, which seems very untraditional on first hearing. That's Patrick Zimmerle's quartet on his CD Explosion from the feisty Canadian label Songlines. Tenor saxophones usually play shapely melodies that move in little steps. Zimmerle likes jagged, wide intervals instead. Guitarist Ben Maunder mostly avoids the usual slinky jazz chords. Electric bassist Stomu Takeishi doesn't walk four beats to the bar like a typical jazz bass player. And his brother, drummer Satoshi Takeishi, doesn't play light swinging patterns on open cymbals. He specializes in the opposite, tight, clipped sounds that allow for fast changes of direction. Yet for all that, they still deal with fixed forms and chord progressions like good jazz traditionalists. It doesn't always swing exactly, but the disjointed parts come together to make their own kind of momentum. Zimmerle borrows one good idea from older jazz musicians. He plays a couple of familiar tunes to help listeners get a fix on what he's up to. One of them is the old Miles Davis vehicle, Seven Steps to Heaven. It highlights one thing the quartet is interested in, tempos that keep changing from one phrase to another. Most jazz rhythm sections allow for minute variations in the basic pulse. It's part of the rhythmic quality we call swing. Zimmerle, as usual, takes an element of jazz language and greatly exaggerates it. The other standard Patrick Zimmerle plays on his CD is Where or When by Rodgers and Hart. Conventional wisdom says ballads are the real test of a jazz musician, and for once, conventional wisdom is right. If a player has soul, this is where it'll come out, and this is where Zimmerle proves he really is interested in old-fashioned jazz values. Where or When is the last tune on his CD, for those listeners who hadn't figured out where he stands already.
Kevin Whitehead is living in Amsterdam this year, working on a book. He reviewed Explosion, the new CD by saxophonist Patrick Zimmerle on the Songlines label. Coming up, Gerald Early continues his reflections on life at an African-American university. This is Fresh Air. Writer Gerald Early teaches English and heads the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. But this academic year, you can find him on the campus of Fisk University, an all-black school in a rundown neighborhood of Nashville. He's writing a book about Fisk, and we've asked him to share his reflections on being there.
I first came to Fisk University in the spring semester of 1994. At that time, my publisher thought I need only one term at the school to write a book about it. After a few weeks there, I knew that the book couldn't be written so quickly. Fisk is a complex place, and my response to it was complex as well. Besides, I was still not sold on the project. I wasn't sure I wanted to write this book. Maybe someone who had attended a black college should write it. During that spring, I could never lose the sense of being an outsider. Fisk is a poor school, and I come from a school that's very well off by comparison. My school resembles Vanderbilt, Fisk's Nashville neighbor, more than it resembles Fisk. The poverty of Fisk was striking, perhaps even unnerving to me, having spent my professional career at rich white schools. The previous summer, when I came to Nashville to see Fisk, I drove past it on 18th Avenue, thinking it was part of the neighborhood housing projects. There were boarded-up buildings and unkempt lawns. Fisk is located in a poor black North Nashville neighborhood. Fisk old-timers like to reminisce about the neighborhood's glory days back in the 1950s and 60s. The main thoroughfare, Jefferson Avenue, the black business district, now has only a few small businesses, a Nation of Islam mosque, and the local chapter of the NAACP. Meharry, the famous black medical college, gives this neighborhood its only institutional splendor aside from Fisk. Fisk's poverty meant a certain number of inconveniences for me. I would sometimes feel guilty about feeling inconvenienced. It wasn't my colleagues at Fisk who made me feel like an outsider. I made myself feel that way. At the heart of the matter, I felt guilt about being a well-supported black professor who mostly taught white kids at a rich white university. Why wasn't I teaching at a school like Fisk, I would sometimes say to myself. In another age, I would have been. Fisk is poor but proud. It has a mission in black education. Its presence means something. What mission did I have? Most of the students here are like any others, interested in the status and income of a professional career. But there is political commitment as well. During the Q&A for a faculty lecture I gave on the civil rights movement, one student asked me poignantly why I referred to the civil rights movement as an adventure for its young marchers. I tried to explain, but he was having none of it. Our people are not engaged in an adventure, he said. We're engaged in a struggle. He asked me other questions, and I was surprised that he had read a good deal of my work. He quoted from it with accuracy. He also hated it. He didn't like the fact that I was critical of Afrocentrism, critical of Malcolm X. He was a very bright young man who wanted to be a writer. He had obviously gone to my work seeking a model and was disappointed. He never spoke to me again, ignoring me whenever he saw me on campus. His attitude upset me deeply. I wanted to shake him by the shoulders and say, "You think I'm a sellout, do you? What about your precious Afrocentrists who work at white schools? Fisk isn't paying me to be here." But he owed me no gratitude because I had come to Fisk. I had encountered this attitude from black students at my own school, yet it was more painful here. The young man didn't think it was important that I had come to Fisk to pay homage to a great school. I felt even more like an outsider. When I left at the end of the semester, I wasn't sure I would return. I was not only wounded, but I felt useless. I had come to Fisk, but I had not arrived.
Gerald Early teaches English and heads the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. He's spending his sabbatical at Fisk University, which is the subject of the book that he's writing. On tomorrow's show, we'll feature an interview with Sonny Rollins. There's a new CD box set of his milestone recordings. We'll close with one of those recordings. This is Darn That Dream. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.